Hello, and welcome to More or Less, where we explain the numbers in the news and in life. This week...
You have to eat 10 tomatoes to get the nutrition out of one tomato in the 1950s.
Really? And...
The economy under this Conservative government has grown by 73%.
No, Prime Minister. Also, are nurses disproportionately led by men? And is there such a thing as a reading age for the UK? But first, last Sunday, armed surveillance officers in South London saw a man they were following leave a shop on Streatham High Road. Within 60 seconds, the man began stabbing people. Within another 60 seconds, the officers had shot him dead. They'd been following him because he'd been released early after being convicted for terrorism offences. The fact that police were watching him has generated extra interest in the case. It was the first thing that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Cressida Dick, was asked about when she faced the London Assembly on Wednesday.
I'm not going to, as you would expect, Amish, reveal any further details of sort of normal surveillance tactics or covert tactics in counter-terrorism operations. I'm not going to talk about numbers. We don't talk about costs.
She might not want to talk about those, but Richard Walton, formerly the head of counter-terrorism at the Metropolitan Police, told the Today programme...
It costs a fortune. We're talking tens of thousands of pounds per week, up to hundreds of thousands of pounds per month, and up to £1 million a year to monitor one offender 24/7.
Loyal listener Stefan May heard that and wrote to us at moreorless@bbc.co.uk.
Tens of thousands a day and millions a year sounds like a job for More or Less.
It does, and it has been before. In 2013, after two men known to security services murdered the soldier Lee Rigby, we asked the former Director General of MI5, Stella Rimmington, about the practicalities of watching people. And here's what she told us.
If you want to follow an individual around 24 hours a day, you would probably need a team of, let's say, six people, and that's probably under-egging it, with cars so that they would be ready either to follow this person away if he went out in a car or to leap out the car and follow him if he was on foot. But that team of people would work for, let's say, 6 hours a day. So you'd need to do it 24 hours a day. You need three shifts of that for one person. And then you might need other people, static surveillance, people sitting in a house, for example, to alert these people when the person was coming out, because you can't just sit outside the house. You've obviously got to sit somewhere else. Then you've got to have a control centre who is obviously receiving the information coming in from these people and directing them. Then all that information has to go to a desk officer who is in charge of the case. So you're building up a large group of people, and we're only talking about one of these manifold suspects we hear about, and doing that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, you're the mathematician. You do the sums. It's an awful lot of people.
Well, I'm an economist, and that sounds expensive. So we're talking about tens of thousands of people, clearly.
Clearly. And the whole art of the intelligence operation is to try and identify the people who are most likely to do something and focus their attention on those people. And of course, that means that you might sometimes get it wrong. And everybody who knows anything about intelligence says there's no such thing as 100% certainty with intelligence.
Dame Stella Rimmington, the former head of MI5, speaking to More or Less back in 2013. Now, we all know that politicians are absolutely scrupulous in ensuring that statistics are never twisted for narrow partisan advantage. That's why we were shocked, shocked to hear this from Boris Johnson in Prime Minister's Questions last month.
This country has reduced CO2 emissions already by 42% on 1990 levels, whilst the economy under this Conservative government has grown by 73%. That's our record. We can do both.
Loyal listeners will remember that the claim about carbon dioxide emissions is actually true. What we want to investigate this week is whether the claim about the economy is true. And I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Anna Valero. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Tim.
So you're from the LSE Centre for Economic Performance.
Yeah.
So you should be able to discuss the economic performance of this government. Is it true that the economy has grown 73% under this Conservative government?
I'm afraid that statistic is misleading. I think what the Prime Minister implied with that statistic was over the period from 1990 till today, the economy has grown in terms of its aggregate GDP, so its national product, by around 75%. So looking at the data, that statistic seems to hold.
So the 73% claim, that is correct. The economy has grown by actually just over 73% since 1990. It's the politics that's not quite right, because for those listeners who've been asleep since 1989, it hasn't been a Conservative government since 1990.
No, exactly, so, yeah. We've had different governments with different policies during that period.
Right, OK. So let's start with 1990 to 97, John Major years. How much did the economy grow over that time?
In that period, in aggregate terms, GDP grew by 15%.
So 15%... over the course of seven years.
Okay. So on average, about 2% per annum.
Okay, and then under Blair and Brown?
Under Blair and Brown, again, it was on average about 2% per annum. It was 31% if you go from 1997 to 2010.
Right, so quite a lot more, but per year, very similar. And then 2010 to 2018, which is the data we've got available?
So over that period, it's about 16% in terms of aggregate GDP, and that's just under 2%. So in aggregate terms, the average annual amounts look quite similar, but right. What we see underneath that, the composition's quite different.
OK, so roughly 2% a year, regardless of who's in power. So you say the composition's different. In what way?
So what we saw in the period from, say, 1979, when the Tories came into power under Margaret Thatcher, through to the financial crisis, let's say, we saw the economy was growing very fast, fast relative to its international peers and fast relative to its own historical performance. But underlying that was really strong productivity growth. So we were keeping track with the US, who was going through its productivity boom during that period.
So all the way through from the late 70s, Margaret Thatcher, all the way through the 80s, all the way through the 90s, we've got Major, then Blair, all the way through to 2007, 2008 and the financial crisis. What you're saying is we actually had good, strong GDP growth and it was underpinned by productivity growth.
Yes.
So just remind us what productivity growth is.
Productivity growth is the output you get per unit of input. If we just step back a second and look at what GDP is, that's what the economy produces. But of course, that's made up of how many people there are, how many workers there are, and then how much each worker produces. And you can break that down further by looking at how much is produced per hour of work, which is a nice consistent measure.
You're getting more bang for your buck.
Yes. And that's basically due to innovation and technology. So that's what you need for sustainable growth. There's a limit to how much more people can work or how much we can expand the workforce. And in fact, we're currently at record high employment rates.
Yeah. So over the last decade, we still had similar levels of GDP growth on average, but you say the composition's changed. So what's changed?
Yeah, so
there?
Within that, what we've seen in the post-crisis period is that productivity growth has been flat. We've actually had, on average, about 0.3% growth per annum in productivity, so output per hour worked. This is actually the worst decade since the early Industrial Revolution.
Say that again?
The worst productivity performance since the early Industrial Revolution.
That sounds really bad.
And actually, the Royal Statistical Society made this their statistic of the last decade.
Right, yes, I recall. Whose fault is that?
So actually, advanced economies around the world have seen a slowdown in productivity growth. And this is more to do with the stage of technological change that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, although I think I'm right in saying that the UK's performance is
uniquely bad. Yeah.
So everyone's is bad and ours is worse.
Yeah, we've done worse. But there is this issue that there are lots of new technologies coming through, but we haven't really felt their impacts in productivity yet.
Dr. Anna Valero of the LSE's Centre for Economic Performance. We asked Number 10 if the Prime Minister had perhaps misspoken when he said the economy had grown 73% under this Conservative government. They did not respond. You are listening to More or Less. And some of you also listen to this. Last November on Desert Island Discs, writer and conservationist Isabella Tree made a rather bold claim about the plumptious berry of the plant Solanum lycopersicum.
You have to eat 10 tomatoes to get the nutrition out of one tomato in the 1950s.
This claim had some loyal listeners perplexed.
Is this correct? Is it comparing like with like?
Which nutrients does it cover? And does it matter?
To help us find out if this is true, we turn to Paul Finglas from the Quadrum Institute, a British research centre devoted to food and health.
Back in 1950, there would have been a very different type of tomato that was available to the consumer.
And was it 10 times better? 10 times more nutritious?
No, not at all. It's very hard to compare a tomato in 1950 with one in 2019. You know, for every nutrient that has gone down, there's probably a nutrient that's gone the other way.
And do you have any idea where Isabella Tree might have got that idea from?
I really don't. I went back and looked at the 2017 publication in the Journal of Food Composition Analysis, and they were talking now about a big reduction in copper values. It said that copper had gone from 0.1 down to 0.01 today. Whereas if you look at some of the data that we have now, we see that folic acid has gone from 5 to 22. And vitamin C, which is quite sensitive, has gone from 20 to 22. So in terms of changes, these numbers might look quite big, but nutritionally wise, they don't make much difference to what you're consuming from the diet.
Paul says the reason why tomatoes seem to have had so much more copper in the past might be down to the variety, but it might also be a measurement error.
The types of methods that were used in 1950 were quite crude in terms of how the copper was measured. So probably what would have been done is you take your sample, you put it into some solution, and then you react it with a compound that gives a colour, and then you measure the colour. Now, the problem with that, there's other things in the tomato that would interfere. So your actual number, it wouldn't be very accurate.
So it might simply be an artifact of the measurement method.
Exactly. Now, what we do today is we use things called ICP-MS, which is inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry, which is a very much more sophisticated technique.
That sounds like a pretty heavy thing to do to a tomato.
Well, yes, but you want to get to the most accurate value you have in your samples.
Is the tomato edible when you've finished with it?
Well, you wouldn't actually eat it after you've extracted it and done the tests.
Okay. So it seems there are all kinds of sources of variation here. So there's the measurement technique used today versus the measurement technique used 60, 70 years ago. And the other thing, though, that struck me is when we talk about something being less nutritious or more nutritious, I mean, there are all kinds of nutrients. And,
exactly.
There's vitamin C, there's copper. I didn't know copper was a nutrient, but I.
Yeah,
you know,
well, there's about, in our food tables, we have about, 35 nutrients.
And presumably for some nutrients, you only need so much, and then anything beyond that is unnecessary.
Exactly.
And other nutrients, you can have too much of a good thing.
Exactly. So typically for copper, you would need about 1 milligram a day in order to meet your daily recommendations.
What's that in tomatoes?
It would be a lot of tomatoes. But in terms of copper-rich foods, like maybe cashew nuts, like for every 100 grams of cashew nuts, you have about 2 milligrams. So you would need to eat about 50 grams of cashew nuts a day. But there's a whole range of foods that would have copper in higher than tomatoes. So as part of your daily diet, as long as you eat your, 4 or 5 portions of fruit, vegetables, legumes, you're going to be pretty much getting your daily requirement of copper.
Paul Finglas. And if you hear an intriguing or implausible claim from the pink sand beaches of a tropical island or anywhere else, please drop us a note via moreorless@bbc.co.uk. Loyal listener Madeline sent in a Facebook post which claimed that
despite the fact that women make up to 90% of all nurses, they fill less than a third of all senior positions.
Madeline wanted to know whether this could possibly be true. Well, despite being a Facebook post, it might be. It was published by the Royal College of Nursing, after all, and you'd think they'd know about nursing. But we did wonder, and here with me to answer this is Ruth Alexander. Hello, Ruth.
Hi, Tim.
So where does this claim come from?
It's from a study called Gender and Nursing as a Profession, which was produced by academics at Oxford Brookes University and commissioned by the Royal College of Nursing.
It sounds solid. Is it true?
Well, about that.
Oh, you're joking.
No, well, it is true that around 90% of all nurses are female. There are more than 320,000 nurses in the NHS in England. Nearly 290,000 are women.
OK, that's not surprising based on going into any hospital and looking around. But what about the more shocking part of the claim, that despite the fact that nursing is overwhelmingly a female profession, women fill less than a third of all senior positions?
No, it's not true. Even though the Royal College of Nursing posted this on Facebook, they've told us, actually, it isn't true. They pointed the finger, though, at the Oxford Brookes researchers, who apparently accidentally spliced two different ideas together to produce an error.
Ah.
Men do hold a disproportionate number of senior jobs in the NHS, but not senior nursing jobs. According to NHS Digital, senior positions across all jobs in NHS England are mostly filled by men. Just 37% are held by women, so a little over a third. And that fact was the source of the confusion.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's not a very cheering statistic, but as you say, it's not specifically about nurses.
It's not.
Do we have any data on nurses?
We do. NHS Digital has supplied us with its most recent figures, and it said first, yes, almost 90% of nurses are female, but the upper pay bands are also mostly female. We reckon about 87%.
And are these upper pay bands for nurses similar to the senior NHS jobs in general?
Well, these are nurses in the pay category of Band 7 or above, and the base salary for Band 7 starts at just under £32,000. Now, senior managers and consultants in the NHS are getting a lot more than that.
So, in a nutshell, most nurses are women, most senior staff in the NHS are men, but it's not true that most senior nurses are men.
It's not true. 87% of senior nurses are women.
Thank you, Ruth. The Royal College of Nursing and Oxford Brookes University have subsequently issued a joint statement, and it says that their mistake
was corrected as soon as we were made aware of it, and we welcome your listeners bringing it to light.
In other words, keep the messages coming in to more or less at bbc.co.uk. Now, this claim from Radio 4's Word of Mouth.
The average reading age in the UK, I believe, is 9 years old. And I know that the government, a lot of government websites, so gov.uk, aim for a reading age of 9.
A reading age of 9? Gosh. Many loyal listeners emailed to ask us about this, but the most loyal listener of all was Graham Martin, all the way from the far-off land of Broadway, Worcestershire.
Can this be true? It seems very low for a well-educated nation. What does it mean? And how has this figure been arrived at? Please investigate.
Now, children, are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. We're going on a fact hunt. We're going to catch a big one. What a beautiful day. We're not scared. Uh-oh, the internet. The big, wide internet. We can't go over it. We can't go under it. Oh no! We've got to Google through it! Lizzie?
Yes, Tim?
I'm getting lots of hits for this claim about the average reading age being 9, but nobody seems to have a solid source. Do you think it might be a fairy story?
Well, what does your heart tell you, Tim?
I'll get back to you on that one. Going on a fact hunt. We're going to catch a big one. What a beautiful day. We're not scared. Uh-oh. A studio. A narrow, gloomy studio. We can't go over it. We can't go under it. Oh, no. We've got to go through it. Tiptoe, tiptoe, tiptoe. What's that? One shiny wet nose, two big furry ears, two big googly eyes. It's a bear!
Tim, I think that's Professor Cathy Russell of the University of London.
Oh, gosh, you're right. Awkward. So, this idea that the nation's average reading age is 9, where does it come from?
The figure doesn't have a basis in reality. From what I can understand, the figure came from a website about content design for websites. And of course, it's important for public-facing websites and government material to be accessible to all individuals. Although the figure that they're quoting, I can't find any basis for it.
Is the average reading age in the UK anything at all? Or does that even the idea of a reading age make any sense?
Well, the average reading age is about 40, because that's the age of the average person in the UK.
Right.
If we wanted to measure reading age, we would really need to know what we mean by reading. And that's hard, because reading is multifaceted. It could be reading words aloud. It could be reading comprehension. It could be something about reading at speed. And we'd have to develop a test to measure that thing.
Right.
If you search for reading age on the internet, you'll be faced with a whole bunch of calculators which offer you the opportunity to get your own reading age. And what these tests normally use is a test called the Schanel. And this is a very old test that many of your listeners may remember doing. And what it gives you is about 100 words, one after the other, of increasing difficulty. So what happens is you read all these words, and at the end, it gives you your reading age.
That sounds like a vocabulary test.
Well, it is. It's an aspect of reading. But the really funny thing about these calculators is that the norms that they're using were collected from a group of Australian children in the 1940s.
Right. So the classic reading age test is in fact not a reading age test. It's a vocabulary test or a pronunciation test. I'm not even sure what it is that's being measured, and it's being standardised against a population of 1940s Australian children.
Yes,
yeah, who no doubt are very wonderful people, but not necessarily representative of the UK in 2020.
And what's more, I mean, the norms are inappropriate for adults. So I took the test and I could read all the words and it gave me a reading age of 12. Now, that doesn't mean that I read like a 12-year-old. It means that the norms only go up to the age of 12.
All right. So you maxed out the test at 12.
I did.
You nailed it. There must be better tests or at least alternative tests of literacy and ability to read. I mean, we have GCSEs, we've got all these tests that are conducted in schools. Do we learn anything from them?
Yes, well, there's quite a lot of data on the average reading ability or the variability of reading within the UK adult population. And one of the best sources of data is from a survey in 2011 called the Skills for Life Survey. Now, this was a large study conducted by the government of adults aged 16 to 65 in England. And actually, the results were pretty good. It was a test of reading comprehension. And what they found was that about 57% of adults were reading at least at the level of a GCSE pass. Another about 29% were reading somewhere in secondary school range, but not at a GCSE pass. And 15% were reading at primary school level. And about half of those were at the lower end of primary school.
Right. So you've got a non-trivial number of people then in the adult population, 15%, who would say these people are really struggling to read. They're reading like young children. In some cases, they're reading like very young children. But it doesn't remotely suggest that the average reading age in the population is 9, if that even meant anything, which it doesn't. But there's a problem there. I mean, 15%, that's not a trivial number of people.
Well, yeah, you're right. Most readers in the UK are good readers, and they're showing satisfactory comprehension. But there is a non-trivial proportion of the adult population that's reading at a very low level. And it's important that we support young children to read better and support adults to access public services that depend on literacy.
Professor Cathy Russell of the University of London, with sincere apologies for confusing her with a big, scary bear. And apologies too to Michael Rosen, the presenter of Word of Mouth, former Children's Laureate, and, the co-author of We're Going on a Bear Hunt. That is all the silliness we have time for this week, but we will be going on a fact hunt again. Please keep your questions and your comments coming in to more or less at bbc.co.uk. Next week's show is the final programme in this series. Until then, goodbye.